This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. In today's edition, we'll examine the resurgence in Egypt of Mubarak loyalists and the Muslim Brotherhood in the wake of a stillborn so-called internet revolution. We'll be speaking with regional analyst Lisa Hajar. There will be no grand jury presentation in the matter of the murder of Trayvon Martin, according to the hastily but belatedly appointed special prosecutor. Meanwhile, there's a sit-in underway at the Sanford, Florida Police Department. We'll analyze the legal and social landscape with Hillary Shelton of the NAACP. Also, real estate and financial intrigues may cause the closure of one of New York's major progressive media institutions. We'll speak with Lenny Charles, the director of INN, the International News Net. Those stories and more coming up on this edition of 5 o'clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, and there are startling developments underway in Egypt, where the transition remains incomplete from the days of the Mubarak regime to the transitional and electoral intrigues. Lisa Hajar is a professor in the Sociology Department of the University of California at Santa Barbara, and among her most recent writings are Omar Suleiman, the CIA's Man in Cairo, and Egypt's Torturer in Chief. And this comes out relevant to the surprise to some announcement that Omar Suleiman is going to run for the presidency of Egypt. What is going on, Lisa?
Well, I think what we've seen as far as the move to put Suleiman on the ballot comes out of a constituency probably, interested in two things. One, you know, perhaps a nostalgia for the pre-revolutionary stability, and or indeed some of whom are endorsers of the Mubarak regime and would like to see Suleiman continue with that. The other dimension is an anti-Islamist position. I mean, Suleiman himself sort of made his name in Egypt and regionally as an ardent opponent of Islamist politics. And given the way in which the Muslim Brothers have been able to really sweep the parliamentary elections, and we're looking, are indeed still looking their candidate as the strongest contender for the presidential race. I can imagine that people who have, in the very recent days pushed Suleiman to run are people who would not want to see the brothers taking over.
Well, that is an interesting intrigue, because there is a viable candidacy being put forward by the Muslim Brotherhood. And according to a poll taken just before the Muslim Brotherhood presidential run attempt announcement, a poll had Suleiman as being a fourth place, 9% approval rate candidate at this point in time, just before the Muslim Brotherhood announcement. And so one of the things we've seen is that the would-be progressives in Egypt were came up against a stone wall, because they were not sufficiently organized, and the internet is no substitute for local social building. And as a result, the more organized Muslim Brotherhood shot to the top of the parliamentary elections and now are emboldened to go for the presidency. The only other institution, I think, as organized in Egypt is the remnants of the Mubarak regime and the institutions of state. So is the Suleiman candidacy simply nostalgia, or does he have a machine to bring to bear?
Well, I don't know if it's probably, a machine in the sense that he is certainly would be a candidate that at least the upper echelons of the military would see as a means for them and their ilk to maintain power even after the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces relinquishes power. Seeing somebody whose entire career was based in the military is something that certainly those types of people would endorse. And Suleiman is also, in terms of maybe his class appeal, he was, like many of the top, cronies in the Mubarak regime, there were two kinds of neoliberal perspectives, one of which was a very, represented previously by the son of Hosni Mubarak, his son Gamal, which was a more transnational, you know, sort of like letting any foreign companies come in and invest and profiteer in Egypt, versus a national neoliberal approach, of which Suleiman and other members of the top ranks of the military represent. So certainly people who are comfortable with that kind of free market approach, but want to see it very much grounded in a national perspective, may find Suleiman, you know, an appealing character. But in that regard, he's not unlike the Muslim Brothers. I mean, the Muslim Brothers are also represent a kind of petty bourgeois, you know, free market economic position, at least the older constituencies in the Brotherhood. And then I think, you know, it is perhaps also because Suleiman is really running, and it's only been a few days since he announced his candidacy, but he's running as the security candidate, which, you know, of course, he comes out of the military and specifically out of the General Intelligence Service. And so for those people who find protracted unrest and, you know, the uncertainty of transition disconcerting at best and you know, sort of horrifying at worst, might find Suleiman to represent just an ability to kind of put down the continuing uncertainty that the revolution has represented.
Lisa Hajar, let's go a bit into who Suleiman is. He is, I would put it, as a hands-on leader in Egypt in particular, with the torture that happened under the American renditions to Libya and his behavior with other disappeared, proclaimed enemies of the state. Can you tell us about what Suleiman is implicated in regard to torture?
Well, one reason, and I will come to that in one second, but one reason that Suleiman's reputation as a torturer is less known and less despised within Egypt is because he really had his hand, like the CIA, he had his hand more in external or, you know, regional types of politics. So many of the people that, you know, whose torture he oversaw or participated in were those in the, you know, Egyptian alliances with the United States and elsewhere. Specifically, I mean, he was the man literally the man in Cairo when, under the Clinton administration, the program of rendition, this was not extraordinary rendition, but rendition was developed. And it was developed, you know, between the United States and Egypt in conjunction. At that time, the idea was to arrest or, you know, even kidnap people and then send them either home to their own country or to a third country. But the purpose was to try them. And there were a number of people who were picked up in, you know, sort of Egyptians who had fled Egypt and were picked up in Bosnia and in the former Yugoslavia and then captured and shipped back to Egypt in the late 1990s. But it was with Bush and the Bush administration and the development of the extraordinary rendition where people were picked up and then transferred, you know, sort of as we call it, torture by proxy. I mean, many people sort of transited through various torture chambers in different Middle Eastern regimes, and Egypt was a favored destination. And so the two perhaps most famous cases of which Suleiman was involved in this sort of the war on terror detainees, one was an Australian, Mamdouh Habib, who was picked up in or turned over by the Pakistanis, ends up in Egypt. And Habib, in his own autobiography, said that he was being tortured personally by Suleiman because, you know, Suleiman, you know, the United States basically assumed that Habib had some information. Of course, Habib was completely innocent of any connection to torture. And, you know, once he got to Guantanamo Bay and was, you know, facing the prospect of a military commission trial, Dana Priest, Washington Post reporter, blew the lid on his treatment, you know, Habib's treatment in Egypt. And as soon as that story broke, the Bush administration dropped the charges against Habib and shipped him back to Australia. And so he subsequently has written about his experience, brutal experiences in Egypt and as well as in U.S. custody.
Lisa, before you continue, I just want to, I say hands-on, and you say that he personally conducted torture. Have any details of exactly what actions he took emerged?
Well, I mean, in Habib's own account, Habib was being, you know, was blindfolded and was being brutalized. And, you know, at one point he recounts that he was slapped so hard that his blindfold was dislodged. And then he saw who it was that was actually questioning and torturing him. And that was Suleiman. And Suleiman, you know, in an effort to break Habib, to get Habib to confess to whatever allegations were being put before him, actually ordered a guard in the prison to kill a Turkestani prisoner in front of Habib, which the guard then did with a sort of vicious karate kick. So, you know, in that particular set of events. And whatever it was that Habib had, you know, said under interrogation, which was then relayed to the United States government and used would have been the basis for his military commission's trial. And it was literally on the eve of that that Dana Priest broke the story. And I think, you know, the implications more broadly for the United States that the U.S. was going to be prosecuting someone and someone who is a citizen of an allied nation on the basis of confessions, you know, or other information elicited through overt acts of torture was something that it was, you know, basically, the Bush administration just put him on the next plane back for Australia.
Lisa Hajar is the author of Omar Suleiman, the CIA's Man in Cairo and Egypt's Torture in Chief. But you point out there is an even more interesting case, that of Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi. Mm-hmm. What happened to him, and what were the global consequences of this particular torture encounter?
Right. Well, Habib, Mamdou Habib, was completely innocent of any connections to terror or militancy. Al-Libi, you know, had been in Afghanistan throughout the late 90s, probably part of the, you know, the Mujahideen forces. He wasn't actually a member of Al-Qaeda, but he was allegedly ran the Khaldan training camp where various militants from various organizations would go and get trained. He was captured while he was fleeing across the border to Pakistan in November of 2001. So Al-Libi was then shipped first to a CIA black site on the USS Bataan, where he was interrogated, made various other stops, ends up in Egypt. And this is now the winter of 2002, sort of January, February. And it was under torture, you know, that Suleiman was overseeing. I mean, Al-Libi was considered, again, like so many of the people who were interrogated, was considered by the Bush administration to be some high-value detainee with crucial information. And the information that the Bush administration at that time was desperate to acquire was some kind of information that would suggest a direct connection between the regime of Saddam Hussein of Iraq and Al-Qaeda, because the Bush administration was eager to start a war in Iraq and needed to be able to sell it to the American public. And the goal of getting evidence that there was, in fact, a connection. And so Al-Libi was tortured in Egypt. And under torture, he, quote-unquote, confessed that there had been, you know, the two Al-Qaeda members had received training in chemical weapons. And that information was what, then Secretary of State Colin Powell took to the United Nations to make the case for war. It was, you know, Al-Libi subsequently retracted what he had said because it was a tortured lie, and there was no connection between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And so then, you know, essentially once the war gets started, Al-Libi more or less disappears. Nobody really knows where he was, and, you know, certainly human rights investigators and others would have been eager to find him. And ultimately, the story then comes back to Suleiman, not only for having tortured Al-Libi in this false statement, but in April of 2009, Human Rights Watch investigators are in Libya doing an investigation of prison conditions there, and they come upon Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi in the courtyard of, or, you know, wherever, in the prison outside of Tripoli. And so then they, you know, immediately, you know, make the announcement, we found al-Libi, and they want to interview him to talk about his experience. And so in early May of that year, 2009, Omar Suleiman flies from Cairo to Tripoli and meets with his counterpart in the regime of Muammar Gaddafi. And by the time Suleiman's plane is, you know, sort of getting off the ground to go back to Cairo, Alibi has committed, quote, suicide, because he was a huge liability. I mean, to actually be able to bring him out of the shadows and talk to him about what was literally, you know, the most, you know, touted piece of information to rationalize the Iraq war, which, you know, subsequently, for anybody who's paying attention, would know that it was a tortured lie. But to, you know, really have this person be available to be interviewed by whomever was bad both for Egypt and for the United States. And so, you know, Suleiman in collusion with the Libyan regime, you know, perhaps, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, anybody would have to be quite gullible to think that Alibi actually committed suicide. I mean, it was probably a murder.
We're speaking with Lisa Hajar. And one final question in the minute or so or two that we have left. What about Kariat El-Shater, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, viable?
I do think he's viable. I think that, you know, if one thinks about the scene in Egypt, one could just say that the reason the Muslim Brothers have been able to have such a strong showing in the parliamentary elections and are likely to be, you know, probably the top candidate is two things. One, I mean, the Muslim Brothers represent a change from the Mubarak regime, and so I think a lot of people like that. And the Muslim Brothers basically represent a kind of economic stability. I mean, they're very, you know, friendly to business and capitalism, but also, you know, sort of the champions of Egyptian, you know, cultural norms, et cetera. So in that regard, I think El-Shater is quite a viable candidate. I kind of doubt that Suleiman could win, for no other reason than that anyone who's happy to have seen the Mubarak regime go is going to see Suleiman as a continuation of that legacy.
Well, thank you so much for such a densely packed presentation of information about breaking events in Egypt. We've been speaking with Lisa Hajar, professor in the sociology department at the University of California at Santa Barbara. And Lisa, where can people find and follow your work?
Well, I publish on Middle East Report. I have an article about Bagram prison there, the website is MERIP, Middle East Research and Information Project.org, and Jadalia, which for listeners, it's easier just to go JAD Mag for Jad Magazine, but .com. So Jadalia and MERIP are the two places that I publish a lot of media, like the, you know, journalistic stuff.
Well, MERIP is a fine institution, and thank you for your fine reportage today, Lisa Hajar.
Thank you very much.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And coming up, an update on the case of Trayvon Martin when we speak with Hillary Shelton of the NAACP.
When Israel was in Egypt's land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell all Pharaoh to let my people go. Thus spake the Lord, bold Moses said, let my people go. If not, I'll smite your firstborn dead. Let my people go. Go down, Moses, way down in Egypt's land. Tell all Pharaoh to let my people.
Paul Robeson. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight, and we're now joined by Hillary Shelton of the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, which has been very much involved in seeking justice in the case of the death of Trayvon Martin. And Mr. Shelton is the director of the Washington Bureau of the NAACP and the senior vice president for advocacy and policy. And today is signpost day in the case of Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman, with the announcement from the, I would say, hastily but belatedly appointed prosecutorial investigator that there will be no grand jury presentation. Meanwhile, there is also a sit-in taking place at the Sanford, Florida Police Department. What is your understanding of the latest developments in this case?
Yes, you're absolutely right. It was determined there would not be a grand jury investigation. But as we know, what grand juries do is actually look at preliminary evidence, determine whether there is enough evidence to bring charges against whoever the perpetrator is, and then take them to trial. Another route that's normally taken, and one that's being taken even now, is the consideration by the prosecuting attorney's office that at the same time, evidence is being gathered, research is being done, an investigation is underway, and they too are in process of making a decision as to whether indeed charges will be brought, whether there will be an indictment, and very well making the decision whether, if there is an indictment, what the charges will be. So in many ways, though the grand jury won't be convened to take a look at this evidence, the fact that the prosecuting attorney's office is still thoroughly reviewing this and has not dismissed it, and because we have not heard from the prosecuting attorney's office if there will be charges and what those charges will be, there's still a very good possibility that indeed Mr. Zimmerman will be prosecuted, as I think so many Americans throughout the country have asked for.
Well, the fact that there was not an arrest is said to be perhaps because of intervention and the fact that the shooter was a son of a judge, and that there were differing opinions among police investigators and the prosecutor's office about this arrest. Do you suspect that the fact that there was not an arrest is an example of what many people in America refer to as not justice, but just us?
Well, I think in many ways there's a good reason for concern under the circumstances. Certainly when you have a case in which indeed Mr. Zimmerman was taken into custody, was taken to the police department, and he was questioned. But I think the issue that raised the most concerns is what happened from that point on, and that is that no charges were brought at that point. Indeed, he wasn't remanded into custody. There was no bail set or anything along those lines that usually go with an indictment. But in this case, you actually have something called a 48-hour rule. That is, time begins running at the time someone is arrested. If indeed charges are not brought within 48 hours, they have to release them. Many attorneys that practice criminal law talk about how important it is that someone isn't arrested, let go, and then arrested and let go before charges are being brought. In many ways, that brings a problematic shadow over the entire case. So at this point, the fact that the preliminary investigation is still going on in the prosecuting attorney's office, that they have moved on it, that the issues that I think most Americans were so outraged about, and that is that you had an unarmed 17-year-old kid that was confronted, according to most of the preliminary evidence that we've all heard or seen on television, listening to the background of 911 calls or the 911 calls themselves, and then actually hearing that this man did pursue him, that he wasn't doing anything illegal, that for some reason, Mr. Zimmerman believes he was, quote, suspicious. Some is a very arbitrary and subjective term anyway, and one that lends itself in this case to racial profiling, that you had an African-American kid that wasn't doing anything, but for some reason he was perceived to have been doing something wrong, or the thought that he might eventually do something wrong, I think was what is most outrageous. And for those of us who are parents of 17-year-old kids, and probably more particularly 17-year-old boys, we know that our children like to go out and they like to be up to themselves sometimes. They like to go for a walk around the block or to the corner store to get some candy and perhaps something to drink, some soft drink to drink. Frank. As a matter of fact, I think we were outraged that the police didn't respond as they should have when someone had, under those circumstances, taken a kid's life.
We're speaking with Hillary Shelton of the NAACP, director of the Washington Bureau and president for advocacy and policy. And Hillary, there has been NAACP participation in, for instance, the recent rally in Sanford, Florida. And there is, one suspects, preparations among the National Guard and other agencies for possible reaction to whatever announcement is eventually made. Can you give us a flavor of what the feeling is in Florida and how that connects to the overwhelming national movement calling for justice in this case? What is the temper of the times about the case in Florida and nationally?
Well, there's deep concern and even outrage. Outrage that something like this could happen, and the perception that law enforcement didn't protect us. That is, people of color, and some people will say just didn't protect us at all. That is, even those who are not people of color. As you know, the marches have been very well racially integrated. I think there is that concern, but I think the deepest concern is the desire for order and justice. That is not what has happened here so far. The order of circumstances when someone unarmed is killed is one in which charges are brought against the people that actually perpetrated the crime. And in this case, that is a point in which it is argued before a court of law and hopefully a jury of one's peers that there was some mitigating circumstances behind this killing. In this case, none of that was done. And the fear, and I think the feeling on the ground, is one of outrage. Why wasn't the law fully enforced in this case? Why is it that Mr. Zimmerman is able to continue to be free? Why is he able to even continue to have the gun that he used to kill the 17-year-old kid? Those are the big whys, and when you have those concerns that aren't addressed, I think people raise them up in many ways. What we're seeing so far are very constructive approaches. Demonstrations mm-hmm. and marches showing that there is an outrage and that something must be done. And many would argue, and so would we, that because we've raised this issue up to the kind of national and even international attention, that people are looking at it, that the process is moving as it was supposed to from the beginning, and that hopefully when this is all over and done, there will be justice for Trayvon Martin, his family, and quite frankly, because so many of us have come to own this issue, recognizing, but by the grace of God, go I or mine. I think it also would bring justice for the entire country.
The NAACP has a long and effective tradition with the Legal Defense and Education Fund. And to move it beyond the immediate personalities and circumstances, we're aware, of course, that ALEC, the legislative subterfuge of a right-wing organization, the Heritage Foundation, has been very busy and through nearly half of the states of the United States pushed forward a cut-and-paste NRA-approved law that is the basis for Florida's Stand Your Ground law. What is the NAACP doing on a legislative and lobbying level to identify and reverse this? I mean, it is so egregious that even the corporations Coke and Pepsi have dropped out of this forum. And what is the NAACP doing about this clandestine legislation agenda?
Well, we've certainly brought it to the attention of the American people that the American Legislative Exchange Council is a group that has actually moved, unfortunately and sadly, to introduce very devastating legislation that opposes so many things, I think, that most Americans stand for. We've made sure that we've revealed the kind of bills they've introduced in legislatures across the country, provided the analysis to see actually how the dots are matched from Florida to South Carolina and from Mississippi, quite frankly, to Michigan. So we've been making sure that people know what's going on. We have actually moved to counter those measures in states throughout the country. NAACP units and state conferences have been working with state legislatures to stop the forward movement that's already underway to repeal those are very troubling pieces of legislation that have made their way through the state legislatures and even been signed into law, and to work with governors in those other states that would do the right thing. For instance, photo ID will many others, a recommendation, vetoed the bill. The same thing happened in Minnesota and other places. So there is a major movement underway to repeal and expose these things to what they are. In the state of Florida, the state legislature has already adjourned for the year. The governor, on the other hand, does have the authority to actually move an executive order to repeal this measure and certainly suspend its implementation until further research and assessment can be done. We're hoping to see that done in many other places and even preparing in places where it would make sense to file lawsuits to try to injunct the full implementation of these very dangerous and devastating pieces.
I'd like to thank you for joining us and briefing us on the Trayvon Martin case and beyond. We've been speaking with Hillary Shelton, the Washington Bureau Director of the NAACP. He's also Senior Vice President for Advocacy and Policy. And I presume people can keep track of what the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People is doing by visiting the website naacp.org?
Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, there's information that they can actually have tweeted directly to their smartphones and actually sign up to receive updates on a regular basis. So certainly going to www.naacp.org, they'll share that kind of information for you and set you up to be actively engaged.
Well, thank you, sir. Hillary Shelton, NAACP. This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacific Radio Network. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And we move now to a troubling situation in regard to progressive media. Listeners to this program may be familiar with the fact that for quite some time, part of the 5 o'clock Shadow presentation has included daily news briefs from INN, the International News Net. But there is a set of intrigues that has made that no longer available to us, at least at this point in time. And in order to find out what just happened, we are joined live in studio by the executive director of INN, the International News Net, Lenny Charles. I point out that INN, for quite a long time, both on satellite and around the world, produced a daily television newscast of great severity and insight and information that goes deeper than the mainstream. I, in regards to disclosure, will admit that I have been a correspondent and sometimes in-studio presenter with INN, the International News Net, for which I'm very proud and very happy to have you in the studio, Lenny.
Thank you very much for having me, Robert, and it was very nice to have you on the show several times and as a presenter and as a guest. We're very happy to have had you join us.
You moved to a radio daily news presentation with the INN World Report, and it was very finely done, and it was certainly one of the pillars of our presentations here on 5 o'clock Shadow. And then several weeks ago, it no longer was extant. What happened and why did it stop?
We couldn't pay them anymore. That's one thing. And the reason we couldn't pay them is because we were in the process of losing our space, our building. One of our board members, back when INN started, a gentleman from Colorado, a little old libertarian, donated the space to us and said, you can use the space and you can use the not only the TV studio but the venue downstairs to raise money to keep the show on the air. And that was very instrumental when we were on Free Speech TV, and it continued to be instrumental as we were creating the daily news briefs for a lot of the Pacifica stations, Pacifica affiliates, and a lot of independents around the country. Well, woes became us. We are in foreclosure and we are in Chapter 11. We are being forced into the situation by a predator bank. And the easiest way to say this, I mean, we hear so many of these stories, but when it hits this close to home, it's hard to tell the story. You know, if money is your god, human sacrifice may certainly be the highest form of praise to your god, and we're kind of falling to that same trap so many people have at this time.
Well, the temple thereof, the temple of your metaphor would be the location at 56 Walker Street, which anyone who's traveled through the metropolis of New York knows is a wonderful venue that has been used many times for important and informative events. It includes a cafe, a theater, and some of the most advanced television and infrared and satellite and other kinds of microphones and equipment that is world class. And it's just incomprehensible to contemplate its loss, its demise. Tell us more about why the space is in turmoil.
Well, the space is in turmoil because there's a predator bank trying to use the bankruptcy court to cleanse bad paper. That would be the story in a bullet point. But it began when the building was under renovation. The building was bought to house INN, and there were some upper floors that were going to be converted into condominiums to pay for the whole adventure. And we ended up borrowing some money from a bank that was insolvent. Well, the bank brought in a partner bank, and they had been insolvent for 2 years before they loaned us the money. Well, they pretended to make the loan anyway. The guys who made the loan
pretended.
Were all
pretended. Did you get the money?
We got the first money. We got the money for the acquisition. We never got the money for the construction renovation. They stopped funding in the middle of it, which is, you know, a banking story, a construction story in New York. They say it's a blood sport. I guarantee it's a blood sport in New York, real estate and construction real estate. But it turned out the guys that made the loan are in jail for 10 and 20 years respectively. It was the second biggest thing next to the Bernie Madoff scandal. It was sentenced by the same judge, and these guys aren't going to be seeing sunlight for a while, except for maybe on the country club prison they might be in, because they're kind of wealthy guys. In either case, they brought in a partner bank, okay, and that partner bank, so they made two separate loans under one joint venture deal. Not too many technical details, but at the end of the day, the SEC had been investigating them when they made the loan to us. They closed them down around the time the loan was done. They withheld money from us from the loan. We could never finish the building. And then a year later, the FDIC closes down the other bank, the two banks that jointly loaned us money. And the FDIC sells the note to a third bank that then is using the FDIC to cleanse the note somehow and come foreclosing, and which is what they did. Now, in order to avoid what they call a summary foreclosure, not to be in too many details, we filed Chapter 11 hoping to get justice. Well, the problem here is in a bankruptcy court, the object is to punish the victim, it seems like in this case, because there's nothing that INN or the board member that actually owns the building, we did nothing wrong. We were really trying to make a go of it. And the good intentions were, of course, to create this support system for alternative media. And at the end of the day, the only solution for the bankruptcy court is to sell the asset and to throw INN out in the street, and that's where we are today.
So technically, at the moment, the building is owned or under the control of whom?
As of last week, it's under the control of a Chapter 11 trustee whose job would be to investigate and reorganize, although we believe that they're just going to try to auction the building out from under us and break our lease at this time. So I've been very reluctant to do anything else there. I had to let the news team go, although they all want to come back, but we have to be able to pay them too. And the venue, the TV studio and the venue and the performance space, were providing money to be able to keep INN on the air.
What are your greatest needs? Are they legally procedural? Are they financial? And what kind of intervention might preserve, protect, and defend this progressive media space?
Maybe 25,000 people. The next time we go to court, they all sit in the courtrooms and surround the courthouse, and we bring in some news trucks. That'd be the world I know, but I don't think that's going to work. Right now, we're hoping that the trustee that's been appointed over the building is going to do what the judge asked. And the judge is trying to be a fair guy. It's just within a bankruptcy court, this is not a court of justice. This is a court of equity. It's a really a different situation. And that's why I say punish the victim.
Explain that. I don't know what you mean when you say a court of equity. What is equity? What is the goal of the negotiations and settlement?
The creditors come first, and the owner of the property comes second. It's like the reverse of being assumed innocent. You're here, you're assumed guilty. You didn't pay back the money. It doesn't matter that you couldn't pay back the money because they wouldn't let you or they put up every roadblock possible. The only thing that remains is that you didn't pay the money and that there are a list of creditors, whether they be contractors, architects, or anybody else, or lawyers that say you owe the money. They come first before you can possibly get anything.
Bottom line driven. And yet you're so close to Wall Street.
We're so close
to Wall
Street.
The manipulation of real estate in this aftermath of the perhaps ongoing mortgage scandal and the shift of resources in real estate throughout America.
Well, this actually is a story of mortgage fraud. A company can't loan you money if they're insolvent. All the funds were commingled. There's no tracking. There was a huge federal investigation. The SEC went so far as to call the parent building, 56 Walker, a victim of a giant Ponzi scheme. Yet in the equity court, the foreclosure court, there is no way to get justice out of this, except for possibly to sue everybody in a different court down the road long after INN is selling their equipment on a street corner.
Who said that, and can you elaborate on the concept of a Ponzi scheme?
Ponzi scheme, let's see, classic Ponzi scheme. You give me some money, I tell you I'm going to do something with it, instead I do something else with it, and I go out and raise more money, telling someone else that I did great stuff with your money. And all I really do is pay myself. The whole idea is that we keep the door, if I'm the person running the Ponzi scheme, we keep the doors open, we make our salaries, we buy our yachts and nice cars and nice houses, keep our wives and nice jewelry, and go out and raise more money to continue the party.
What have you got, a 30, 40, 50 footer?
My yacht, yes. It's actually, I'm down to my last yacht, I have to confess. It's parked out in the bottom of the river over there.
Uh-huh. Our guest is Lydie Charles, the director of INN, the International News Net. And Lydie, I'm glad to have you in the studio to talk a bit more about the very philosophy of Promethean news, of bringing dangerous information to the public, of sharing those blazing things that are smothered in conventional media. What is your philosophy or intent in being a producer of news presentational materials?
There's news, there's news spin, and then there's reality. We try to get as close to, we try to combine reality with morals. It may seem odd to say that it could almost be called religious. It was very sad to hear last week that Ron Paul was speaking the golden rule to a group of Republicans and they started booing. Well, we don't boo, we kind of cheer that.
I thought they liked gold.
They like gold, but they don't like the idea of, you know, we can do whatever, we should be able to do whatever we want, but other people can't really even have a reaction to it like that. And in our case, we really do believe in social justice. We do really believe in equality for people. We're not big fans of dictators. We're not fans of the empire. We're fans of right and wrong, just that simple. And you can't say you're right or my right or your truth or my truth. It becomes kind of obvious when the bombs come falling on their children. So it's a really simple way to say it, considering how many stories we do and how deeply we know how deeply we study the news. But it really becomes that simple when you really want to have some guidance in how you're going to present these stories to people.
Can you think of any examples of stories in which INN has taken a leading differential position to the false truisms of conventional media?
One that we did right after Barack Obama was elected, I heard on Rachel Maddow's show the other night, and it made me realize and know that we had done something right a long time ago. And we had on Manfred Nowak, who was the UN Special Rapporteur on torture. And we had him on there, and he was citing chapter verse and treaties and U.S. law and everything else, and how Barack Obama had a legal obligation to investigate and potentially prosecute the Bush administration. Okay, well, Bush held his ground at the time. Well, we thought we were doing the right thing. And just last week, Philip Zelikow, who's no friend of anything resembling a 9/11 investigation, came out. His internal memo was released by the Freedom of Information Act, and he indeed was the lone voice with a memo that was circulated within the Bush White House saying, like, we can't torture. And then Rachel was actually nice enough to go ahead and include that John McCain's platform was certainly anti-torture, and when he was debating Mitt Romney, you know, 4 years ago, Romney's position was more in line with the Bush administration's. Well, that shows you where that's gone, but we appreciate that Rachel finally got the story 4 years later, and this is good. And that was a story we did. We also were, like some other shows here in Pacifica, we were very excited and very saddened during Operation Cast Lead. And we had reporters on the air with the bombs falling in the background, and it was, we even had a surgeon on that had just gotten off the operating table where we saw that there were weapons being used that nobody had ever seen before, and they were being given to the Israelis by the U.S., and the results of those were devastating.
Did that include the phosphorus?
No, this is beyond the phosphorus. These were, I believe, air cannons that were containing some kind of particles within that were causing these instant aggressive cancers, and people shouldn't have died from the wounds, but they were getting these horrible cancers instead of days. The guy's name is Dr. Juma Al-Saka, I believe, and we had him on during the invasion of Palestine, and horror stories. His son sent us, and because it was a television medium, his son sent us these pictures, you know, over his cell phone at the time. We were able to air them, and they were horrific. I don't want to say the only news is bad news, but these pictures really told the story of what was going on over there, and we heard so many other stories. But we tried to focus a lot on things that humans shouldn't be doing to each other, no matter who they are. And that was kind of our beat. We really, you know, felt the duty to try to let people know and that this was the reality of the world, not what they're trying to tell you on even MSNBC.
How did you build the world-class technical environment, the equipment, the cameras, the audio, the satellite, the distribution network, and have there been changes in the current modality of news and information presentation, of course, the internet and all that stuff? How did you approach this project technologically?
Well, I hate to say we had some corporate help. I would go to Home Depot in the evenings, and I go to a lot of these auctions where other studios went out of business, and I'd get equipment, incredible equipment at, you know, professional television equipment at pennies on the dollar, and just any way that I could, we'd put it together. We actually, early on, before we were in the financial, you know, straits we're in, we bought a used truck satellite dish, an 8-foot satellite dish, and it's mounted on the roof of the building. So we just left the truck behind and mounted that up there and bought an FCC license, and then I have an electronics background as well as a broadcasting background.
The hard part was lifting the truck, right?
Lifting the truck. No, cutting it off of the truck and getting it up the side of the building. But so we actually, when we were going to Free Speech TV every day, we were broadcasting live from the top of the building, KU band, which was a technological miracle that we pulled it off as often as we did. I designed the studio, the equipment, and I've been doing it for so long I don't think about it.
But. KU, raindrops keep falling on my feed.
On my feed, that's it.
That's a technical joke, folks. The wavelength is about the size of a raindrop, and sometimes
there are
outages.
One thing that happened very nice technologically is that we still had a news team together. We had a falling out with Free Speech TV. We renamed them Fee Speech TV, but... And I think that they finally took their Democratic Party card out of their pockets and waved it around. So we figured, okay, enough with these guys. But the news team was still there. So we weren't doing the interviews. And Tom Colley, who was my co-host for the longest time, and we started it together. He's doing a radio show on Libertarian Radio. And so he took over the interview part. We kept the news team going, and... the Pacific affiliate started picking it up, and the news team is great. They were doing incredible research. They'd go out to all the blogs, all the foreign sources. They'd aggregate. It was hard to get firsthand reporting when we were just doing radio, as we had been able to do with television. But they were aggregating some of the, let's say, more difficult and interesting stories out there, and we'd offer them using internet technology by placing the actual audio files on a server on the internet, and then letting the Pacifica stations and some of the independent stations take them down, put them in their playlists.
Well, Lenny Charles of 56 Walker and the INN International News Net, the World Report of INN, and so on, in this closing minute or so, tell us how your vision will persist.
We would like to see INN certainly back on the air. INN was very fortunate in that it didn't have to go out begging for money to stay on the air. It had the benefit of the proceeds from renting out the building for community events, functioning almost as a community center, so we'd give all the people using it a great price, but it would be just enough to make salary every week, and we kept going. So we'd like to see INN back on the air. We've got to find a way to pay the folks. I still have the equipment. We need a space. I don't know that the party's over, but... for right now, we're taking a little break, let's say.
Well, now is the time for all good people to come to the aid of a progressive media institution. And finally, Lenny, how and where should people click or correspond in order to perhaps offer a deus ex machina or to otherwise assist?
Well, we're not really asking for money. We never liked asking for money. But if they'd like to get involved, correspond with us, any way they can, just go to INNWorldReport@gmail.com. We're keeping that open. We're not updating the website.
Yeah,
We have to pay someone to update the website. But if they'd like to correspond with us, any of us, innworldreport@gmail.com. We'll get back to you, and we'd love to hear from you. And we're very appreciative to our audience, who is no audience. You're not telling anybody. So we'd like to thank all of you out there also.
Well, it's important to have a smart audience. Thank you, Lenny Charles, for joining us today on 5 O'Clock Shadow. And best wishes for the future of INN. And that concludes today's program, which was produced with Thiago Barroso and engineered by Michael G. Haskins. We welcome your comments, leaks, tips, suggestions, and questions with an email to theshadow@wbai.org. That's theshadow@wbai.org. And for 5 O'Clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.